And this, can I just introduce you? This is Sam. Sam Dix is also an archaeologist. And Sam's very lucky. I tell him this every day, but I'm not sure he believes me. But he's very lucky because he is going to do a PhD with me. So he's going to spend the next 3 or 4 years working hard, I understand, doing nothing but your PhD. And he's going to do it on the Willow Port site. So he's going to do it on the barracks, probably, the underfloor material from the barracks, and analyse all of that material and find out what it's telling us. So I just thought I'd drag Sam along so that he could tell you a little bit about his project, just so that you know what he's doing. So
my project at the moment is focusing on the barrack sites, so that 1830s building, the U-shaped building down here. And I'll be looking at that earlier phase, that's sort of between 1830s to 1855, when it was under control of the imperial government, so when it was still part of, you know, the larger British Empire. What I want to try to understand a little bit more is about the more personal stories and the people that were inside that institution. This was an area that was set up for convicts, but ended up admitting free settler patients, pain patients, as well as poor patients. So you had three different classes of people in this area. So what I want to try to learn is how they interacted, if there was some form of hierarchy between, you know, social status, I guess, within that was being placed within the institution. But also, through the archival evidence, we have a lot of contradictions. We have very two extremes of the barrack site. We've got, on one hand, people saying it's brilliant, it's fantastic, it's a great place to be treated. And then you've got the other side that say it's horrible, it's terrible, it's a hellhole. So you've got a lot of these contradictions, and they come through different mediums, journalists in newspaper articles, official reports, so forth. So we also have case books and patient books as well, but they're all very clinical, I guess. They're not the actual about the people that are there. It's not their story. So what I hope through archaeology is to find out a little bit more about how that was working, and whether or not, we can see here there's, embroidery happening, there's something, that people were spending their time doing things, but what was actually being done, if there was any form of underground illegal economy maybe running through the system. It's well documented, especially now you might have heard the Port Arthur's found gaming tokens and so forth in the back of the penitentiary. That seems to be a convict-based thing, and this site did have convict staff working. So, if it would be great if something like that turns up, if there was something like that happening, and how that also worked between your convict class of patient and your fee paying and pauper patient. Mm-hmm. We're going to look at that mainly through underfloor.
It hasn't changed much, so has it? When my wife had our twins, we were public admitted patients, and then there was private insurance over here, and you walk straight from our room into their room. Maybe the same thing happened here.
A few things I want to sort of examine, and especially with the archaeology, is get a better understanding of the rooms, how they're set up. I want to be fairly clinical myself in how we'll examine the archaeology, because I guess traditionally you see your time teams have got nice big layers of history happening, sections where they can dig down. What we're dealing with underfloor deposits is, unless it's a room that's, had the roof changed, every 4 months up, did the roof and there's rubble on the ground, they've redone it. But if it's a fairly intact room, we're looking at very fine layers of build-up, cultural build-up as well. Examining what has potentially fallen through the cracks of these boards, what might have been deliberately stashed under there or hidden away, just to whether it be contraband, for example, and you know, you're not supposed to have it, so you quickly stash away, or personal items, you know, special things, sort of like what we've got here, that became a little bit of a hoard of items. But to the point where, you know, it might be good to actually look at areas spatially as well, understand where people went in a room, whether or not there's, say, a larger concentration of artefacts in one section, and why there might be a section there. Could it be that was a site that may have been out of the view of guards or ward staff, and therefore you can sit there and do what you want to do, and things fell, or you know, if you were illegally trading things or whatnot, and whether or not things were stashed there because of line of sights and that. So, in a nutshell, that's what I'm hoping to look at and dedicate 3 or 4 years of. I think I'm going to be in the right place at the end of 3 to 4 years.
Yes, yeah. No, you're so lucky.
Yes.
But what I'm hearing is you're looking at patient experience, right? Well, it was for the people.
Patients and staff, you know, this is I think it's sometimes easy for the staff to be forgotten in these, especially when we're talking about convict era stuff. But, you know, these were staff that were overworked, they were understaffed. And up until...
Never enough beds.
And especially in the early days, they were actually sleeping in the wards, so they didn't have their own accommodation. So there was a lot of pressure on their staff, and they did see a lot of things. They did have to manage a lot of things, and how they lived their lives working, and how they coped, and whether or not you know, there's some archaeological evidence of staff experiences as well.
Just for the other people in here, my name's Mark Woodley, and I'm one of the other speakers talking about the built history, and this is why I'm glad we've come in here to listen to this. I spent 8 months working in the barracks doing restoration work, and what I've come to notice now that I'm thinking about how hard were they doing it, the intervention into that building, like its first acceptance of electricity, looking at the light fittings and stuff like that, that probably didn't come along until probably the 1940s or 1950s, and there's no other evidence in that building that I can see that showed that they had anything modern up until that time. So that suggests that that is a 100-year period where the building probably had nothing more than candles or oil lamps.
Yeah, well,
and if the staff are in there with them, it's not as if it went through acetylene gas and then it came up to... I know that there was 32-volt electricity sort of came in and started the 20th century, and then we've built up to our modern 240. There's no evidence in there that suggests that anything happened until about the 1950s and 240-volt electricity. So before that, it would have been quite primitive.
Yeah, and it's interesting to say that, because there is evidence stating that they were pushing, because a lot of time it was like the kerosene lanterns, and... If you think if you're in a hospital situation like that, they're actually a very dangerous thing to have. And there's documents around that are pushed about, okay, well, we can't have these things because they're a fire hazard, even though there isn't. Then there's one recorded fire which was lit by a patient back, I think. I've got to look into it a bit more. You did have a fire hazard there, so they were talking about having gas and all sorts of things. But you know, it was interesting that there's electricity wasn't there. Really thought. I guess you know, it would be part of my job to look a bit more into that part of the history as well. But you know, why wasn't it?
Why it's so long? For a government institution,
is that sort of the course of what it was? It was just. Push to the side, that's a last thing you do.
Yeah. Well, the whole history of the institution was always too many people and not enough money. Yeah. So it was always overcrowded and there was never enough funds to go around. And that's partly why they kept a lot of those old buildings, like these ones. right through until the 20th century because they just couldn't afford to massively rebuild. They couldn't afford to demolish everything. They couldn't afford to take the institution and re-erect, you know, a new one somewhere else. So there was always compromises being made, and you can just imagine that there's compromises that we know of from the documents that people complain about, and then there's those kinds of compromises that you wouldn't know unless you'd actually looked at the details of the building. So I didn't know, because I know they had power in 1902, but maybe never to that building, which is really interesting. So which buildings are having it, and why, and then what's happening, who's relegated to the rooms in that building, and what does that mean for their lives versus...
The only reason I could probably have a little bit of authority on that is my father, proper, he's an electrician, so... I got an idea about electricity and what cables would have carried what currents, and everything in there suggests that it came along quite late.
I want you to show me all the cables and come back in February next year.
Yeah, well, as a plaster, you know, there's sometimes we have to repair that. It was quite brutal what happened to some of these early buildings when they wanted to introduce electricity. They would just dig holes through walls and chase them in.
There's very little thought
into the aesthetics. But probably that's the thing that maybe saved it, instead of punching holes through subfloors and ruining plaster on the way through.
So when was power in this building?
I don't know about this building. So I'm not sure about where it was connected to different parts, but I know they got power in 1902, at least to some parts. It's kind of the only detail you can only get from material evidence, because no one records which buildings were connected when. But by looking at the cabling and the other things that Martin has about, we might be able to figure that out.
Do you know anything about treatments?
Well, there's a lot of clinical files in archives, so you can go to the archives. There's lots of records of the surgeries, like, because it was also an invalid hospital for people, and accident cases were often brought from outside. So if someone had an accident, they'd often rush them here. It'd be like the de facto emergency ward, even in the 1840s, 1850s. So we've got lots of evidence of treatment, but they're in that very sort of clinical format. Some of the stuff, some of their surgery and medical treatment they were giving to patients, though, was really cutting edge in the 1840s, 1850s. It was like, you know, this place, you think of it as New Norfolk is a long way away from anywhere, and so therefore whatever's happening here is a long way intellectually from anywhere else. But in fact, there's a woman from UTAS who's done a whole PhD on the medical treatment and comparing it here to Bermuda, and then I think a major hospital in London. And in fact, this one doesn't come off too badly. They were doing really incredible things. Like, it's, I think, one of the earliest uses of ether as an anaesthetic. And that was like about, I think, maybe 13 or 16 months after it was first used in the United States ever. So it's something that they'd heard of, and they were experimenting and they were trying it. And it was this really, it's this incredibly traumatic case of...
Dr. Pugh in Launceston, he was the first surgeon in Australia to perform surgery on anaesthetic.
And they did it about 6 months or 8 months after he did it here.
Wow.
So like, it had all these amazing things. And so we do know quite a bit about treatment, and we have in the council collection, so when the hospital closed, a lot of the objects that were collected as part of the legacy of the hospital came into council hands, so it's been stored in various places over the last 15 years, 16 years. And in there's some ECT devices and things like that, but it's sort of very fragmentary. The material evidence of treatment is very fragmentary. The best sources are the archival records that we might be able to get from the archives.
I would think that because it is so far away, you know, and these are mad people and these are poor people or convicts, you can try things without anybody looking too closely.
You know? I mean, you think how much over the period from 1830, even just to the beginning of the 20th century, how often medicine itself was revolutionised in that period, and how much surgeons were learning from other surgeons. And to think that, you know, how long it took just for information to get from, say, the US to Australia and then from Australia to New Norfolk, I think they were actually not... I don't think it's this horrible, dark, locked away thing that we think it is. I think the more we delve, the more amazing things like that you might find. And there's... Have you seen, like, the two books, the one by Gavin Crabb and then the one by Gowland about this site?
I read something when we first moved here 10 years ago.
Kind of two sort of histories you can get about the place. And the one by Gavin Crabb has this photograph in it of this really early static electricity treatment device. So not electroshock, not the big, you know, panels that we think of when you think of one for the cuckoo's nest, but it dates to the 1850s, so it's incredibly early, and if that, it doesn't exist as far as we can tell anymore. The last time anyone saw it was the 1960s. But it would have been a revolutionary treatment device. It would have been something that probably only existed in a few places, and the fact that it was here, and then when Gavin Crabb talks about it, it was something that was just stuck in an attic because it was so old no one even knew what it was anymore. Mm-hmm. But very early static electricity treatment device. So I actually think they were probably doing things here that we just don't know until we delve more into the details, and we might be surprised about some of the things. I think you're right, though. I think there'd also be horrible things happening, and there'd be stories that are the opposite of that. So it's just seeing what the material evidence tells us, and, you know.
So the buildings as a whole, it's about care, essentially. What was it, these buildings, what were the roles of these of this site in those post-war years? Was it a convalescing place for the Boer War people, First World War people, Second World War? Did it play convalescing sort of approach?
Convalescing for people with mental illness. So it wasn't. So although it was initially set up as an invalid hospital for people who were ill, like physically ill, and an asylum, I think it's after about, I can't remember the date, but it's like about 1849, it becomes purely just a mental asylum. So just
Because I was just thinking about the advances in surgery, and did they have war people coming back and need shrapnel dug out of them? And
not that. A lot of people coming back with what we would now call PTSD and other, you know, yes, that's right, other problems that were caused by war, and I'm sure that there are a lot of them here.
That's why we've got Mobile Grime.
Yeah.
Because that was actually open for return service people in 1934, and it became part of the hospital in about 1950-something. Yeah. So they joined together, but they were sharing staff in between times. So technically, the hospital was still open because
and the other thing you get too here, which I think is interesting, is an increasingly aging population. So you get a lot of dementia patients. So from the 19th century onwards, what you're doing is you're treating a lot of the older people who can't live by themselves, and they wouldn't have understood dementia or in any of the ways that we understand it now. And you can just, you know, all those kinds of behaviours that go with dementia would have just been seen as some kind of mental illness that they couldn't quite explain. That's right.
Like I said, I'm working in the right place, I think. Just checking.
But look, those patients, we wouldn't put them in, we wouldn't pigeonhole them in that way anymore. We wouldn't mix dementia up with other kinds of mental illness.
There's a lot of people who work within the dementia area now that still had a history of working here. Because a lot of the stuff actually developed from here. And there's some really good stories about one of the wards, how it broke up into three different separate houses. And they tried a whole new philosophy, a more of a social philosophy over a medical philosophy within the medical institution.
Because it was here for so long. I think, you know, it led the way in lots of respects, as well as being behind the eight ball in terms of economy at the time.
It's the choice of New Norfolk. It's satellites, it's a satellite town, to keep this sort of stuff away from Hobart town itself? Is it, let's keep this
I don't know why. I don't know why they picked this spot, so I don't know the answer to that yet. But there were certainly lots of convict gangs and things working around here, so there was a lot of convicts who needed invalid treatment, you imagine. But the Hobart jail was also overcrowded, so they were looking for a way to get rid of about 127 out of the Hobart jail and put them somewhere else. And New Norfolk had a reputation for having good air, like, you know, being a healthful place to live. So it might just be that combination of having to treat, you know, ill people, invalids, and having to put them in a place that was, away from Hobart so they could move those people away, but also it was a place that had a healthy kind of reputation anyway as a place to live. But
and
I don't know.
Sort of had that more of a, instead of being, the occupant of Her Majesty or His Majesty, and this place was more about convalescing and care.
Parts of it were. So the barracks were. So the barracks is what was built as the invalid hospital, but the square behind that, the courtyard that doesn't exist was the asylum.
Brutal, really.
Well, and if you think of it, you're just mixing everyone together in one place. So you've got the old, you've got the infirm, and there's a lot of records that suggest that what the British government were doing was sending out convicts who were not able to work in the first place. So it's not just that the convict system here worked them until they broke down physically. A lot of them were sent out with like one leg or one arm. And so the government here was continually complaining, saying, stop sending us these convicts who can't work, because all they were doing was offloading that problem and making it the colony's problem and not caring. So you've got people who seriously need looking after. A lot of them are older.
I had no idea that they were sending out broken convicts.
Yeah, they were sending out actually insane convicts as well as read about Irish convicts being sent who were classed as lunatics or insane, still being sent out to here. So it was. I guess it was just a convenient way of offloading.
From my reading of history, New Norfolk was kind of on the frontier with bushrangers and Aboriginals, and the reason that we have a barracks was because it was for the army originally, for the fear of bushrangers and Aboriginals, because it was kind of the limit of civilization at that point in New Norfolk.
Yeah,
so the very initial building was an army functioning building, and I think the invalid aspect of it came because you've got a building here and you've got some sort of security, so use it for something else, move people out from Hobart to something that had been built here anyway. That's kind of my understanding of why it's New Norfolk. Because it was going to be at Prince of Wales Bay in Hobart, and that was too close to Hobart. So then they had the asylum, the barrack building, the military establishment here, and you had military disabled people, so they kind of put one and one together.
And there's the river as well.
And Hagar McNabsey, of course, the summer residence, so it was a known location. But you already had the building here, you see.
Yeah.
So you wouldn't have to put a new building somewhere else to...
Oatlands had that sort of three levels of... it was a military town, free settler, and convict. They're all three sort of gelling into one another, and slowly the military side faded out of it. But it was that... Well, it ended up having a Supreme Court there, and the only one in the colony at the time, and they... regional district outside of what then became the major centres of Hobart. So that Tassie was, I think they had plans, but I think things were going so fast that they halfway through building something and then it's all changing real quick. So yeah, they probably did have grand plans for New Norfolk. They did say that Oatlands was being groomed as the capital for Tasmania at one point, and that's why there's so many stone buildings, and they set up a Supreme Court there. It must have been just the speed at which the place was being colonised, and